This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Good afternoon to you. Hope you're well this afternoon. Shortly, talking about Western Australia positioning itself as the hydrogen energy capital of the world. Plant protein burgers go mainstream with Hungry Jack's keen to roll them out ASAP. We'll talk about that after 12:30 today. And to kick off today, it was 30 years ago that the WA grains industry decided to create a noodle wheat segregation and look for export opportunities in the high-value Japanese market where the thick wheat flour noodle udon is king. Last night, that move was celebrated as a huge success at an industry dinner held in Perth. But there was also acknowledgement that growers deserve a premium for this noodle wheat, and not just when it's in short supply. And there was also talk of expanding market opportunities with China, a potential new market for this noodle wheat. Retired Agriculture Department scientist Graham Crosby was right there from the start, arguing for this noodle wheat segregation way back in 1989. Graham, what was the catalyst to creating this noodle wheat segregation all those years ago?
Well, it was a realisation that particularly the leading variety, which proved to be a very valuable variety, a variety Gabenya, the leading variety in Western Australia from 65 to 85, was on the decline. It was at last being replaced by higher-yielding alternative varieties. And unfortunately, the other varieties didn't have the qualities that Gabenya had for udon. And it was dropping very quickly. It fell from 44%, I think, in 1983 to 17% in 1988. And I had just returned from a AWB-sponsored trip to Japan, where I'd encountered some concerns being expressed over there about a decline in quality. And so I was worried that our reputation was going to be affected by this. And that's why I suggested in March of 89 that we create a special segregation to concentrate the dwindling supplies of Gabenya and another variety, Eridu, which was starting to build up but not to a greater extent than the decline in Gabenya. So the combined sowings of Gabenya and Eridu were on the way down, and we needed to capture them to make sure that our shipments to Japan contained a reasonable percentage of this special wheat.
And this idea of a segregation for noodle wheat then, how was it received, Graham?
By quite a few farmers, very well. But unfortunately, AWB opposed it at the time.
And why was that?
It was more the separate pooling, the idea of putting together the proceeds from the sale of the wheat and then giving it to the growers who produced that wheat. Their concern was with respect to the effect that would have on a national ASW pool that had been in existence since AWB was formed. And that meant that if we took out a premium component from that, then the returns to Eastern States growers would be reduced. And that's what we had to argue about, I guess, for 3 more years. Although the segregation came in 89, the separate pooling didn't come in until 92, 93.
And what were the growers in Western Australia doing at the time too? Was there a push from that grassroots level get this over the line?
Oh, yes, yes. Particularly a group from the Mullewa area led by John Hawkins. They contacted me soon after I had suggested the segregation and separate pooling. Those people and I worked together to argue the case. We got the segregation in that following season. So that was okay, but it was the separate pooling, as I say, that was
the battleground.
Battleground, yeah, that's right.
Now, what about Talk us through the premiums that growers have got over the years since this was all created 30 years ago, because it does go up and down, and it's even gone, you know, lower than just the standard wheat varieties at times.
It has, and that's one of the problems. And I think, you know, there are a couple of possible solutions to that, and that is for advice to go to growers. And that was one of the aims of the Noodle Wheat Growers Association, which unfortunately folded for various reasons in the 2000s.
On ABC WA, this is The Country Hour. I'm Belinda Varaschetti, and this is Graham Crosby, a retired Agricultural Department scientist, who last night was part of the celebrations of 30 years ago when the grains industry decided to create a noodle wheat segregation, and sort of celebrating that fact. It was celebrated last night as a huge success, that decision all those years ago. So what is the way, Graham, to turn that situation around and have those premiums for growers who want to grow noodle wheat from now and into the future? How do you ensure that they've got that premium into the Japanese market?
Well, as I say, you've got to make sure that they're not overproducing. And so this is where guidance, I think, would certainly help. I mean, a lot of growers are only growing a fairly small percentage. Some of them would be growing, say, 15% of noodle wheat. Yes, the problem is that if they overproduce, the return is reduced. We've got to give them guidance on what the prospects are for the next season as best we can. And the marketing, of course, really is very special. It's very important that we be arguing on the basis of quality. It's all about quality that we're talking about. And so instead of just putting in a tender and getting it either accepted or not accepted, we need buyers and sellers to come together. That's been, I think, fairly obvious for some time. It's unfortunate that the tender system, which applied when AWB was operating and sole marketer, that was pretty easy for them to, well, not so, nothing's very easy, but they didn't have any opposition from overseas because this wheat is unique. So the Canadians and Americans don't produce this type of wheat.
But still today, they don't produce a wheat that sort of suits the udon market.
No, that's correct. That doesn't have the high quality that our noodle wheat does have.
So what are those qualities?
The key quality that's really made our wheat so different from others is the starch. You know, we used to think of starch as being a fairly inert thing and everything related around the protein, but the ratio of those two is important, and the quality of the two components. Yes, so it was the starch that we found was the critical factor. It contributes very much to the texture of the noodle.
Tell us about this udon noodle. What goes into it? Because it's a fairly simple sort of recipe when you have a look.
Well, you're quite right, and I think that's why high quality is the key factor.
Because it is just what, flour?
Well, it's just flour, water, and salt. It's a very basic formula. Whereas, say, in the case of instant noodles, because often the wheat that is being used for instant noodles is not perfect or ideal, and certain additives have to be added to instant noodles. But in our case, with our noodle wheats, there's the texture that's critical and the colour. And it was very interesting that I mentioned the importance of gamenya. Gamenya gave a creamy yellow coloured noodle, and this was the colour that was really needed. I can remember going when I went to Japan in 1988, trying to clarify just what the colour was that they wanted. I'd thought it was a white noodle, but it's not. It's a creamy yellow. And the moderate level of yellow pigment in gamenya gave it that colour. So there we are with the right texture and the right colour in gamenya. And it's those qualities that we are looking for in the new varieties that have been released. And, of course, we've had a fair bit of success in that. But they all have to go through very stringent tests to qualify for udon noodles.
It's interesting that you talk about, well, the udon noodle and the colour being so important, because I was reading this week in the Australian Financial Review about this time the Indonesian market which has been sourcing a lot of the wheat for their noodles from, well, not Australia, sort of going over to places like the Black Sea, for example, to get the wheat to make the noodles. But in this article, it was saying there's been a bit of pushback from the customers because the colour is not quite right. They're used to the Australian wheat producing the noodle and getting the colour spot on. So now they're tweaking with it and putting sort of bleaches and chemicals in there to get the colour right.
Well, that's right. You know, there is we do have a competitor for the oolong wheat, and I said it's not our major competitors, Canada and the United States. Japan does produce wheat, and I think something like 600,000 tonnes at the moment out of a total of about 1.6 that they need. And they've done quite well with their breeding. I understand that the latest varieties have got quite good texture, approaching the texture that we get from our wheat, but their colour is down, and that's a very important aspect to say when you're selecting noodles. Brightness is important, and a moderate level of yellow pigment.
So, Graeme, what does the industry do from this point? It's been 30 years since this segregation for noodle wheat going into the Japanese market was set up. So all these years later, where do we take this, the industry take this from this point and ensure that we still have access to that market going forward?
The Japanese themselves have introduced a system called the SBS. It's called Simultaneous Buy-Sell. And that does involve interaction between buyers and sellers. And that has actually been used in the marketing of prime hard wheat from Eastern Australia. But it's not being applied to udon. And that's what I think we need to do. We need to extend that system to West Australian udon wheat. I think that's the solution. If we can get buyers and sellers together and then they negotiate with a good understanding of the quality requirements, then I think we're going to press home the advantage. It will revert us to where we were when we had the single desk in AWB, because there was no real opposition. They were still putting in their tenders, but they also had the opportunity to negotiate with the Japanese. So there were much more buyer-seller interaction. In relation to the future, I think we've got to try and avoid overproducing that wheat, but perhaps we need to be looking at other markets where that wheat may have some application. And China is one of those markets.
Why China?
Well, they produce a lot of noodles, a lot of dried white noodles. I know one company there that's producing something like 800,000 tonnes of dried noodles per year. And some years ago, I was over there in China working at a workshop, and we had something like 90 people from the noodle and flour milling industries at this workshop, and I took the opportunity to get their reaction to Japanese udon compared with their own, and there was quite a level of interest there, and it's indicated to me that perhaps there is potential for some of our noodle wheat to go there. And in view of the vast quantities, it could well have an impact. There could be regions in China where that wheat would be of value.
Graeme, really good to talk to you on the Country Hour today, and it sounds like it was a good night last night.
Oh, yes, we had a great time there. And, yes, the noodle wheat growers from several noodle wheat growers from the Mullawa area were there, and it was good to catch up with them.
I bet it was. Graeme, good to talk to you today. Thank you.
Thank you, Belinda.
Principal of Crosby Grain Quality Consulting, that is Graeme Crosby, who many years ago was in the ag department. He was a scientist there. He's retired now, of course, but he was right there at the time arguing for that noodle wheat segregation back in 1989, and that 30-year anniversary being celebrated at a special industry dinner held in Perth last night. 19 past 12.
The WA Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Radio WA.
A broadacre cropping machinery specialist says that now that the WA grain harvest has started, there are a few things that you can do just to ensure that you're getting the most out of this season's crops. Glenn Reithmuller is from the Department of Primary Industry and Regional Development, and he's got a few old tricks and a few new ones to help you get as much of the grain into the bin as possible. And he says it all starts with sharp blades.
The first thing you've got to look at is getting the knife sections nice and sharp. They should actually prickle your finger if you rub your finger along the edge of the knife section. And they should actually cut nicely against the bottom of the ledger plate in the actual knife guard itself, like a pair of scissors. It should cut nice and clean. And that should be adjusted all the time anyway, even in good crops, because one of the header courses recently highlighted that there's a fair bit of power involved in the knife sections. And so if the knife is cutting nice and clean, it should reduce the power onto the drive. But it's more important with the shorter crops, of course, because cutting it neatly will allow the heads to fall backwards onto the knife section so you can deal with it later, whereas a blunt knife will tend to tear it off
and then it flicks forward, doesn't it?
It flicks forwards, that's right.
What are some of the other things that we can do?
Well, then once it's been cut and it tends to sit near the knife then, and that's a bit of a problem because normally you have enough bulk of material to keep sweeping it back with the reel pushing it back. With the shorter crops, it can tend to fall forward. So another thing you can do is add extensions to the knife guards so that that cut material can fall onto that, and then the next bit of material coming in can push those heads or pods further back in. But then the next thing, of course, is, okay, so it's cut and it's sitting on these fingers. How do you get it back into the front? The most common reel we have on the harvesters now is a tine reel or a finger reel, and unfortunately they don't grab the material. They can't do a sweeping action like a can in a bigger, bulkier crop. What we found in the past works fairly well is to put some black material like plastic zip-tied onto the reel to help sweep, to go down close and actually touch and brush the top of those the knife guards to sweep in that material. Now, you only need one piece per turn of the reel because if you put it on every section, you can't see through the reel to see where you're going. So it turns into a wall. But one section is enough. Generally, by the time the reel comes round with the build-up on the knife, that one section can sweep it in. And then we found our driver here at Meriden, he found he was getting headaches from watching this thing because what happened was we put a section of plastic or core flute along the reel, and then the next section coming round, put it on the next one, and so it created like an auger effect. And his eye started following it from one end into the centre, and he said it was giving him headaches. So what we suggest is not to have it in sequence, to actually break it up a bit. So like if it was on the first section of the tine reel, we'll then go skip until the second one on the next pass. We certainly don't want headaches. It's been enough of a headache cutting short crops as it is, let alone having something distracting you like that.
So core flute, that's that light plastic that is used in real estate agents and politicians
use? That's right,
yes.
That's right. Unfortunately, they're usually made of white material, so unfortunately recycling that is not so good. We did actually try spray painting them black, but the black paint tends to wear off. But the reason it's need to be black is at night time, anything white will reflect in your eyes from the header lights. There is a new material, though. One of the growers called me about it and showed me a piece of 3 millimetre thick high-density polyethylene. Some people use it in the back of utes to stop scratching of the material and whatever. And it's sold in sheets, a bit like core flute. It's a little bit dearer, but it's much more hard-wearing. And also it's easy to fit because you can drill it with a drill, whereas the core flute you actually have to punch because it doesn't drill that well. So the ease of fitting and the harder wearing made this HDPE a good option, I think.
And you use that in exactly the same way, make sure that it's spaced randomly.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. Exactly. Yep. Now, the next best option, of course, is to sweep this material in, is not the reel at all, but to use air. Growers who were at Darren this year would have seen that the Harvest Air have got an air reel back again. It's now available for the 30-foot out to 45-foot. A bit like the original air reel, with a manifold across the top, across the front, but it's made of aluminium, so it's light. It can push so it fits in front of any existing tine reel.
How much difference do these kind of strategies make to the amount of grain harvested? And ultimately, I guess it's the money in the bank that we're thinking about.
It's a variable thing, that, but I noticed Peter Newman did some loss measurements there and found with canola particularly, some people are putting out huge amounts of losses, you know, above 200 kilos of grain on the ground, and simply by adjusting the fan speed, they got it back to 50. So, I mean, there's a lot of money to be made by just having a good look. Now, that raises the issue about, well, how do you know what your losses are? Well, another new thing that's been recently around is, and there's a few companies selling them, is called a drop tray that you can attach to the back of the harvester or to the side, wherever you want to measure your losses anyway, and it drops down with a remote release, and you then clean the material that lands in that tray, and you can actually have a good look at what losses are coming out, and then you can change things, change settings, to see if you can improve it. And it's not always about the least losses. It can be about the keeping your harvesting capacity up with the least losses. So if it is only a simple change, you might be keeping your speed the same. We don't want to see you having to slow right down to reduce losses, because then, of course, your depreciation of your harvester, is that cost can be high, and you're lot longer harvesting too. So there's a compromise between harvest speed and capacity and your losses. But if you're measuring your losses, at least you know what that is.
Some handy hints for you this grain season from Deep Herd's Glenn Reithmuller, catching up with Lucinda Joson, going through those handy hints about how to get the most out of this year's grain harvest. 25 past 12. Off to Western Australia's far north now, where farmers in the Ord Valley are having one of their best chickpea harvests ever. Ideal weather conditions this dry season have seen yields rise dramatically, and farmers are now starting to think about new ways to market their premium Kibbouli chickpeas. So to tell you about some of these value-adding options, here's Kununurra farmer Fritz Bolton.
Currently, most of our customers are their ageing customers, so we know that potentially in the future there'll be less demand for this incredible food. And so we're looking at things like chickpea flour, or as even roasted chickpeas as a confectionery type snack, trying to really make it a bit easier to consume.
And is that something that you think the Valley's far away from doing?
Look, there's still a bit of R&D. There's work being done at the moment, and it will just take time. We're excited about the potential of cotton, and that's taking a fair bit of time, and currently obviously establishing these extra markets for the corn and handling this extra product, there's only so much we can do. But we think chickpeas will be a part of what we do in the Valley, and they're quite a difficult crop to grow, but the flavours that we get out of our chickpeas here are extraordinary and really, really special, so I think it will be something that'll be around for a long time.
And potentially, you know, food provenance is so important to customers at the moment, increasingly. So that story behind the chickpeas and the Valley and the progression of how long you guys have been trying to perfect these crops, I mean, that's got to resonate with customers as well, you'd have thought.
We hope so. You know, and there's been some good work being done with some new varieties that NACRA is trialling, and we're really, really pushing the fact that it is something special up here in the Kimberleys. We've got the sustainable farming systems, we've got ample water, and plenty of sunshine, and are really growing a fair dinkum product. So we've been here since the early 80s, and this is probably the most exciting time in the Valley that I've ever experienced. And it was extremely exciting when we got a sugar industry, but I think where we are now, with the maturing of businesses and capacity to really develop the marketing and production systems around these new crops, it's really, really exciting.
Kununurra farmer Fritz Bolton, he sounds pretty positive, doesn't he, about the role that chickpeas will play in the Ord Valley's future. And he was speaking to Courtney Fowler. At the moment, the crop, it's only really a small market for farmers in the region, but that could change if they're able to produce those ready-to-eat chickpea products that Fritz was just telling you about, like the chickpea flour, the chips and other pulse products. Here on the Country Hour, it's 29 past 12, and Sandra Shimane-Burke in the studio with the news headlines.
Thanks, Belle. Australia's Defence Minister Linda Reynolds says it's too early to predict the consequences of the United States' withdrawal from northern Syria. Some Republicans have urged President Donald Trump to reconsider the move, arguing it could result in the slaughter of Kurdish allies. Two Extinction Rebellion protesters have been arrested while trying to enter the offices of the West Australian newspaper in Osborne Park. Park, about 50 climate change protesters were involved in the demonstration. A gold mining operation in WA's Midwest has suffered a major mechanical failure, which has shut down its processing plant for nearly a week. Westgold Resources says routine maintenance at its Bluebird Mill near Meekatharra uncovered the problem. And in cricket, three West Australians have been named in Australia's 14-man squad for the upcoming 2020 series against Sri Lanka and Pakistan. Ashton Agar, Ashton Turner and Andrew Tai have been included. Belle, I'll be back at one with a full bulletin.
Thank you for the preview, Sandra. 12:30.
The WA Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Radio WA.
A big hydrogen energy get-together was held in Perth this morning. Richard Hudson went along to that, and he'll be in the studio shortly just to go through what was spoken about there, because it looks like Western Australia is really positioning itself as the hydrogen energy capital of the world. We'll get to that shortly. And also talking about how one of the big burger chains, Hungry Jack's in this particular case, is keen on these plant protein burgers. We'll catch up shortly with the owner of Hungry Jack's just to talk about, well, he's eaten a few burgers in his time, so he must have been pretty impressed with what he's tasted. So we'll get to that here on the Country Hour between now and the news at one. Of course, the results of the Mushay sheep market today. Tracy Kilner with you just before that news bulletin at one. Off to the Weather Bureau now. Austin Watkins has the details for you today. Austin, how's it looking in northern and eastern parts?
Well, plenty of sunshine today and very hot conditions with a lot of heat building up through there the last few days. And we're certainly set to see that continue through those northern parts. The high in the Bight will keep driving those easterly winds through there. So coupled with the dry conditions, we will see elevated fire dangers continuing mainly through the Kimberley, inland Pilbara and interior. And it will move down into the sort of southern interior during tomorrow and on Thursday as well, when a surface trough begins to move through those southern parts. But in the way of precipitation, not a great deal. There might be the odd storm or shower through the far north Kimberley today, and we can see similar conditions tomorrow afternoon as well through those parts. But it's not until Friday, or even Saturday, I should say, where we may see some rainfall start to develop through the southern goldfields, the adjacent Gascoyne and also the adjacent Eucla as well, as a mid-level disturbance begins to develop. So showers and thunderstorms may develop through there. But in the way of falls, probably only a couple of millimetres at most. And if you're lucky enough to be under a thunderstorm, if they do develop, you may see up to 5 millimetres through there. But otherwise, generally pretty dry through the next 4 days for northern and eastern parts.
Well, there's certainly some hope of some rain into the agricultural parts of Western Australia. So let's move into the Southwest Land Division. I think there's a few days of sort of summer conditions before we get to the possibility of that, though, Austin. Can you talk us through it?
Yeah, that's right, Belle. We've got the trough near the west coast, so that's bringing the heat to the Southwest Land Division today, and the trough will begin to move inland tonight, and it'll move through the southern districts tomorrow, eventually reaching sort of the goldfields tomorrow evening, and so the heat will begin to move eastwards with that trough. So no rainfall expected sort of tomorrow or on Thursday, but during Friday there are hints of just a weak front or a band of showers that will develop and move through the southwest corner of the state on Friday. So we'll just see showers at this stage reaching the Capes during the morning and then just gradually moving through the southwest of the state. So anywhere sort of southwest of the line from Perth to Bremer Bay, eventually getting showers in the afternoon and evening. Generally light falls, though, at this stage. But on Saturday, we're starting to see the models firming up with a middle level disturbance developing, pretty much right over the southwest land division. So the shower and thunderstorm activity looks to be increasing during Saturday and pretty much ongoing through the day, and then eventually weakening and easing and then moving east on Sunday. But there are some signs that under a thunderstorm, as I mentioned, for the goldfields and those adjacent districts, even through central and eastern parts of the Southwest Land Division, that includes majority of the grain growing areas, that if you're under a storm, maybe 5 to 10 millimetres might be something that you may receive with those passing storms. So little bit of promise ahead for Saturday, but otherwise dry and warm conditions until then.
All right, well, we'll certainly keep an eye on that throughout the week. With those temperatures today, the next couple of days, what are we getting up to? It's sort of late, high 30s, sort of 37, 38-ish in parts?
Yeah, looking tomorrow, sort of inland parts of the central west, the Wheat Belt and the Great Southern, looking at sort of 37, 38 degree temperatures for some locations, anywhere sort of away from the coast and away from the southwest corner. And then sort of by Thursday, the majority of the heat has moved into sort of the goldfields and the Gascoyne, but still lingering temperatures in the low 30s through those far northern and eastern parts of the Southwest Land Division. So it's not until that front comes through on Friday that really cleans out that hot air and we get those more milder spring temperatures again.
Let's just recap those warnings.
So currently we've got a strong wind warning for the Esperance Coast today, and then that area will just increase to include the Eucla Coast as well tomorrow. And we've also got a fire weather warning, which includes the Kimberley Inland, the West Pilbara Coast, the Ashburton Inland, and the Northern Interior Fire Weather Districts.
Austin, thank you very much for that. Appreciate it. It's 25 to 1 here on the Country Hour. No rainfall over 5 millimetres anywhere across Western Australia. That's in the last 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning. We'll get to the Mouchet Sheep Market for you just before the news at 1. And as we were talking about yesterday, you are going to meet one of WA's oldest axemen. His name is Robert, or Bob Reynolds, 82 years old, still going strong. He's been competing for years. I think, is it 30 years or probably more? We'll meet him shortly here on the Country Hour. Before we do that, though, as I mentioned just a few moments ago, it looks like Western Australia is trying to position itself as a hydrogen energy capital of the world. That was one of the take-home messages from a hydrogen strategy update forum, which was held in Perth this morning. Richard Hudson went along to that. Richard, why is hydrogen energy suddenly being talked about again?
Well, hydrogen is being talked about because Australia's hydrogen strategy is just about to be released. It'll go to the state and territory energy ministers in December before being released then to the public. So today's forum was fairly hastily arranged to coincide with the availability of Dr. Alan Finkel. He's chair of the National Hydrogen Strategy Working Group. And as you're probably aware, he's also been Australia's chief scientist since 2016. So they only had 2 weeks' notice for this forum, and 265 people rolled up. So there's obviously a bit of interest in hydrogen.
But we have been hearing for years that hydrogen energy will be the clean, green replacement of fossil fuels. Many people are sceptical that will happen anytime soon. Was that addressed this morning?
Sort of. This morning, Dr. Finkel pointed out why he thinks it's important to get a hydrogen energy industry up and running, most of it associated with climate change. He says, the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions from human activities is from burning fossil fuels for energy. So, for example, for electricity, heat and transportation, oil, coal and gas are the main culprits. And when you consider what's happening at the moment with climate change protests all over the world, maybe there's a greater sense of urgency now than ever before to actually have something, actually working, happening.
So is Dr. Finkel saying hydrogen energy should replace those fossil fuels?
Well, he thinks it can, definitely. He says electricity created from renewable sources like wind and solar can be used to split water into hydrogen and oxygen, and then that hydrogen can be used as clean or zero emissions energy. It can be stored, transported and exported.
All right, so where does Western Australia fit into all of this?
Well, WA's Regional Development Minister, Alana McTiernan, was another guest at the forum this morning, and she's been a long-time champion of hydrogen. You might remember, as Transport Minister, Alana McTiernan conducted a 3-year hydrogen bus trial that started back in 2006. At the time, renewable energy and hydrogen were just too expensive for that to be basically swung into action big time. But since 2009, the costs have come right down. And in more recent times, Alana McTiernan has now ensured that WA has its own renewable hydrogen strategy. And she reckons there's potential for renewable hydrogen exports from Australia to be worth about $2.2 billion by 2030. And that's not too far away.
But why Western Australia? Does this state have an advantage over other parts of the world for the production of hydrogen?
Well, Terry Kalis certainly thinks so. He's the executive chairman of Hydrogen Renewables Australia, and they've scoped out all of Australia, and he thinks a place just north of Kalbarri in WA is the absolute best spot for their ambitious project.
Yes, so we've identified the Murchison House Station as being the best combined solar wind resource in the country. That's what we believe. What we've been doing over the last little while is working with the pastoralists and the local Nunda Aboriginal Corporation to get to a point where we can achieve a Section 91 licence that allows us to put monitoring equipment on the site to actually, you know, basically prove what we believe is the case. The next steps for us will be to consult with the community. We plan to do that in late November and also start conversations with parties who may look for equity and or offtake. The other thing we have been doing is partnering through the process with our technology partner, Siemens, who is a global leader in the development of electrolyzer technology.
So why does Terry Kalis and his company, Hydrogen Renewables Australia, think that spot is better than others?
Well, he says the main things they're looking for are plenty of wind, sun, land and water, as well as good access to markets. And WA's Murchison region ticks all the boxes.
Yeah, so if you look at the best combination of wind and solar, there's some independent reports actually highlight that, number one, and we agree with that. We obviously also need to look at where we can make sure our costs stay down. So we haven't gone further north because basically the conditions are cyclonic, and if you have cyclonic conditions, you can increase your cost, particularly the structures. So where we are is a sweet spot in that sense. The other thing that we do from a site perspective is we look at all the environmental and permitting issues. We've done a study on that, and there's no unmanageable issues. But that did highlight probably the best thing for us to do is desalinate, which is what we're going to do. And the third positive for the site is its proximity to the markets. So proximity to the Asian markets is just fantastic compared to most places in Australia.
So it sounds like a big project, but I might stress, you know, Terry Kalis does admit it's still very early days for this project.
And it sounds ambitious.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? They aim to develop the project in stages, though, over about a decade. They aim to generate up to 5,000 megawatts of renewable energy, 70% of that coming from wind, 30% solar. They hope to build an electrolyzer plant that'll produce the hydrogen. They want to use desalinated water from the coast, and eventually they want to target exports into Asia. And the ultimate goal is to supply about 15% of the Japanese market by 2030. So again, still early days. But I did ask Terry Kalis what this project will actually look like on the ground on Murchison House Station.
Yeah, it's too early to say, but if you basically split, on at least on the wind side, and said, you know, you had 3,500 megawatts of wind and you had 5 megawatt units to make the math easy, which is now possible onshore, you know, you're talking about 700 turbines.
And what about with the solar panels?
Yeah, solar panels, it depends. But, there, you know, there'll be several hundreds of acres of solar panels there.
Terry Kalis from Hydrogen Renewables Australia. What were some of the main hurdles that Dr. Alan Finkel thinks needs to be overcome before this industry actually gets up and running, Richard?
Well, the three that keep him up at night are scale, demand and competition. So scale, the sort of figures he's talking about are pretty scary. We need to dramatically increase the amount of solar and wind farms in Australia quite dramatically. Obviously, lots of water is needed, but Alana McTiernan believes desalination plants could solve that problem, or underground aquifers, which WA has some of as well. The demand, though, is an interesting one because it's just not there yet. Dr. Finkel admits that. But he showed some figures this morning where, you know, places like Europe, Japan and South Korea, they are investing billions of dollars into hydrogen research projects. So the industry is obviously building.
This sounds really similar to where the LNG industry was, you know, in the 1970s or 80s. Was anyone from the LNG industry at this morning's forum?
Yeah, there were representatives from all sorts of mining and resource companies. One was Bernadette Cullinane, and she's regarded as a global LNG leader. And her advice was, don't do what the LNG industry did with companies basically competing against each other all the time. They kept reinventing the wheel, doubling up on resources and infrastructure and such like. So she said, please, just collaborate. And Dr. Finkel's take-home message was, carpe diem.
Thank you for that, Richard. Richard Hudson went along to that forum this morning. It was a hydrogen strategy update forum held in Perth this morning, and just talking about how Western Australia looks to be positioning itself as a sort of hydrogen energy capital around the world. It is 1:45.
On ABC Radio WA, you're with Belinda Barischetti for the WA Country Hour.
Great to have you along this afternoon. The move of plant-based proteins or fake meats has taken another step closer to the mainstream with burger chain Hungry Jack's announcing it's investing in the sector. A new product line called V2 Burgers has been developed by the CSIRO and Jack Cowan of Hungry Jack's. Now, Jack Cowan says they're made from grain legumes and taste very similar to beef burgers, but he doesn't see them as a direct threat to beef farmers.
I think it is very comparable to beef products. I said at a function the other night that I think I've probably consumed more hamburgers in the last 50 years that I've been in this business than most Australians. And I had a taste test of product A and product B, and being a long time consumer of beef products, I got it wrong. And so it tastes good. And the real story behind the plant-based protein is the fact that we have 7.5 billion people on the earth. We're going to 10, and the existing agricultural system cannot produce enough food as we know it today to handle the growth of the population.
So put simply, you think there's a bit of money to be made in this?
Yes, we in our particular business, the fast food business, 50% of the population are not consumers of fast food. The Generation Z, which are the probably the children of the millennials, are very much in favor of products that are planet-friendly, that have anything to do with the environment, that and you know, the killing of cattle, the various methane gases and things like this that are involved in raising cattle. They have a very high level of attraction for this. So if we can attract new customers by offering a broader product base in our Hungry Jack's business, we think that that will broaden the appeal that we have to the general population.
I know you've previously expressed some surprise that people enjoyed an earlier version of a vegan burger that you've been selling at Hungry Jack's. Do you think that this is about people's motivations or about taste? What do you think drives it? Because you're saying, you know, this younger generation, they're interested in the environment, they're interested in sustainability. Are you?
I think it's both, probably. 10% of the Australian population are vegetarians. About 3% are vegans. We in our Hungry Jack's business, we sell a vegetarian vegan product, which is made from plant. That does not carry the same taste attributes that this product does, which was developed through CSIRO, which has worked very closely with us in developing a product which we think tastes good. And so you can sell a vegetable product to appeal to that vegan audience, but on the other hand, if the real market, the 90% market, is what we call flexitarians, which are those that eat meat and plant based products. And that's the bigger market, so that's what we're aiming at.
Is it cheaper?
a vegan burger?
The number one burger which we sell in our business is called a Whopper, and the introduction of the product in around the country is being introduced today, and it's the same price. In North America, where there are two kind of major plant-based products that are being sold, they sell at a premium. One of the advantages we have of some of the benefits of a grain, Australia's a big grain producer, so a cow is an inefficient producer of protein. So we can get the cost down. It's going to sell at the same price.
There's obviously
rather than a premium.
There's been a lot of pushback on some of these products around the world. France has banned the use of terms like burger or sausage for any food that doesn't contain meat. In the beef industry here in Australia, there's clearly a degree of skepticism about it. How do you respond to those fears?
Well, I don't know. I don't think there is any fear aspect to it. I think. We sell in our business. We sell 30,000 tons of meat. We hope to be able to continue to sell the same amount of beef as we always have. I don't think this is going to come necessarily out of the beef. What we think will happen is we can attract a different audience that aren't currently buying these products because, for environmental reasons or sustainability reasons, whatever you want to name it. So we think that there's a customer base that we will be able to attract that we're not currently getting. We don't think we're necessarily an enemy of the beef industry.
Jack Cowan from Competitive Foods speaking to RN's Hamish McDonald. As I mentioned, the move towards plant-based burgers came about when Hungry Jack's teamed up with the CSIRO to create this V2 food startup. And the company's being led by former Master Foods and PepsiCo research director Nick Hazel. And you'll be able to hear what he has to say on tomorrow's Country Hour. He's no stranger to food markets, and he thinks the growth in plant-based meat isn't just about veganism and vegetarians. He says that the main market is actually meat eaters increasingly concerned with sustainability. You'll hear from him, Nick Hazel, here on the Country Hour tomorrow. 9:01, we'll get to the markets shortly, the details of the Mushay sheep market for you. But first, wood chopping is a tough job at any age. So imagine doing it competitively at 82 years of age. That's the age of WA's oldest axeman, Robert Bob Reynolds. Now, Bob was raised around the timber industry in Manjimup, and John Daly caught up with him on the sidelines of the veteran woodchop competition at the Perth Royal Show.
Action. Steady your logs. Get ready. Right. Well done, Bob.
Oh, yes, it's a sport that gets in your blood, and it also it's an individual sport where if one week you don't feel good and you don't do very good, you don't upset anybody except yourself. It's a good hobby. And I tell the grandkids when they're cutting there, it's a good run you can do for a long time.
Now you're in your 80s, 82, is that right?
That's right, yeah, it's 82.
What do you reckon? Is it the elixir of longevity, competitive wood chopping?
No, I think it might be bacon and eggs for breakfast.
Some people at your age wouldn't be able to do what you do.
No, it's quite. I do quite a lot of training. And in actual fact, I'm in the standards, I'm quite fit, because when I chop a log off, it'll take me 60, 70 seconds, and the good ones will cut it off in 25, so they're not even working. And here I'm slugging away for a minute and a half.
What's your training regime like these days?
About three times a week I have a bit of a heavy axe and dry logs, and I belt them, chop with them until around about 50 hits until I'm completely worn out, and I feel my pulse when it slows down. I do it again, and I do that three times on the stand block, three times on the underhand, and then I go to a crosscut saw and go as hard as long as I can on that.
Now, your roots are actually in the forestry industry in the southwest, is that right?
That's right. We shifted from Manjimup when I was nine. My old man, he was a wood job, but he also pegged the Gloucester tree and about four other trees. As far as I look at that, he climbed them up and cut the tops off and put cabin on them. And all he'd have around his waist was a bit of 200 feet up, a bit of clothesline.
Yeah, right.
That's right. And he smoked like a chimney.
Did he get you into wood chopping?
Oh, I guess you do. You are inclined to follow your parents. I never got on very well with him, but I followed him. Same as my son, I never pushed him.
Yeah, well, your son and your grandson now compete, don't they?
Yeah, son and three grandkids competing at the moment. All the country shows you go to, it's a family affair. The whole family stops there and watches it all day.
You know, you mentioned you're not as fast as you used to be, but do you reckon you got the technique down pat?
I've had it and I've lost it. I can't twist and bend properly, especially that underhand end on the one side. I've got a hit wrong because I'm not twisting properly. I know what to do and how to do it, but the old muscles don't help you much. But I've had a good run with the wood chopping. I was in that event, that tree felling event there, I was the state champion for about 20 years. I've been told that by several of the people here that I'm cutting better than I cut ever. But that's not for a long time.
That's all right.
Yeah, because I am quite fit, really. But that's probably not just raw bacon and eggs.
But what do you love about it?
Oh, it's the fact of when you do it wrong or you get a bad light, you get a bit upset for a few minutes. And the camaraderie of all these people here, you know, it's terrific. You would have heard that they just brought axe throwing into Perth and they're advertising that as letting off steam. Oh boy, you let some steam off here at this.
You've been letting off steam for 65 years.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, that's right, yes.
So you're also doing a bit of a special chop today, actually. You're doing something for charity. Do you want to tell me a bit more about that?
Right, well, it's a broad axe that you use and you cut sleepers. Early in the century, all the sleepers that were used in England were cut here in our southwest, West WA, with probably 100 more people with broad axe felling the trees with a crosscut saw and splitting sleepers and sending them away to England, and our own sleepers, of course. And this is just a demonstration of how it was done 100 years ago.
Did you used to do that in the bush with the broad axe?
No, not really. I'm not that old. I've done some in the bush, but not for a living. When they did it for a living, these old bushes, they had it made. They'd be out in the bush, they'd have a fire going, and they'd be boiling the billy. No noise from chainsaws or anything. Just work away and make 3 times the best wage. Knock off in the middle of the afternoon and go and shoot a kangaroo and a possum and get the skins and make a bit more money. The old bloke said that was tough, but I reckon I had a good...
You're a bit of a legendary axeman. Is there any end in sight for your competition days, Bob?
No, I don't think so.
He's just going to keep going, isn't he? Bob Reynolds, he's been competing in some of those chopping competitions for quite some time now, and no stopping him. You can see Bob in action if you head to the ABC Rural Facebook page. I just had a quick look. I didn't see it there, but I think it's about to go up, a video of Bob in action, so you can see him doing his stuff at the Perth Royal Show. Let's get to the markets now, and sheep numbers were up at today's sale at Mushay, over 1,000 more than last week. The total yarding was 13,000. Tracy Kilner was at the sale. Tracy, was it a good quality sale?
The quality was generally good on all classes, with store sheep dominating the market. Prices were equal or up for most lines, with demand increasing for store ewes as the sale went on. The heavyweight lambs in score 3 condition in the carcass weight range of 22 to 24 kilos made from $146 to $159 to return an average of 660 cents per kilo. Trade weight lambs in the 20 to 22 kilo range sold for $125 to $158 to return estimates of 656 cents a kilo. Score 2 lightweight merino lambs made from $80 to $106 a head. The young merino ewes remained firm to sell from $50 to $112 to average $75 a head, with graziers picking up the heavier weight lines. Mutton prices eased with numbers offered. Heavyweight ewes over 24 kilos carcass weight range sold from $92 to $133, including skins, to average 393 cents a kilo carcass weight. Lighter score 2 boning ewes down to 17 kilos carcass weight made from $50 to $86, and very, very light ewes as low as $28 a head. Good medium weight ewes in the 18 to 24 kilo carcass weight range made from $75 to $116 a head. The young wethers sold from $80 to $118 to average $96 a head, while older wethers sold for $55 to $107 for lightweights and $105 to $138 for the heavier pens. Rams sold from $40 to $90 depending on weights and quality to average $63 a head, and the lightweight ram lambs offered returned $40 to $100 to average $72 a head. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you for that wrap, Tracy. Earlier we were talking about how Western Australia trying to sort of position itself as a hydrogen energy capital of the world. A few thoughts on that on the text. Stuart says, where do you find these people? Hydrogen fuel, i.e. gas. What is the carbon footprint of building the wind turbines and the solar panels begin with will be huge. Then they want to desalinate water to make the hydrogen, so they're taking seawater out of the environment, plus the waste salt problem doesn't make sense as there are easier ways to make hydrogen. That's from Stuart. And this from Greg. I think hydrogen is the logical fuel for Australia, both for baseload at non-producing times for renewables and also for long-haul Australian roads. Plus, it's exportable. Unfortunately, the car manufacturers don't want to think about hydrogen because they've invested so much in electric vehicles. Dr. Alan Finkel says there's not much difference between hydrogen electric trains and there's big potential. 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.